what are the limits to free speech in our society, and should there be any? That question coming up. Good Thursday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9 a.m. Also, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, One Jax's civil discourse program is taking a look at the First Amendment and where the limits are in today's polarized world, if there are any. What do you think? Exercise your First Amendment rights right now and get on the line at 549-2937. Then later, from the First Amendment to the Second Amendment, it's real talk today on the show as African-Americans in the city talk about the gun debate. Plus, a live in-studio performance from performer Robbie Litt. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, in America today, the First Amendment protects our speech, of course, no matter how hateful or hurtful or vile. It is a robust protection we enjoy in this democracy. But as time goes on, will we continue to support absolute freedom of speech? Or, as some are now arguing, are some limitations needed on free expression? Such as what's happening overseas in Europe, where some countries are passing explicit laws banning hate speech. Is that an American way of doing things? That's the question that's going to be asked next week at the latest installment of this city's Civil Discourse series. This is sponsored by the Florida Times Union, WJCT, UNF, the Jacksonville Human Rights Commission, and One Jax. And the questions about the First Amendment are certainly a uniquely American discussion, and it's one that we very much look forward to having at the event and also right here on this program as we welcome One Jax Executive Director Nancy Bronner to Studio 5. Good morning.
Good morning.
A little later in the hour, philanthropist and humanitarian Laurie Dubow, a One Jax Silver Medallion Award winner, is expected to join us too. So here's our question to callers. When it comes to civil discourse in an uncivil, polarized world, are there or should there be any limits to free speech in America? Give us a call with your thoughts, 549-2937. That's 549-2937, or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and we are already getting many comments from you on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Here's one for you, Nancy Bronner, as Tim writes, there are no limits to freedom of speech other than the rule that you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Our rights are enumerated quite clearly in the Constitution. That's always been my understanding of the First Amendment, too. As long as you're not physically endangering others, you can say what you want in this country. So what is teeing up this discussion? What prompted this discussion in the latest installment of the Civil Discourse series?
So we find that there's a lot of misunderstanding about the First Amendment, especially when there's been a lot more hate speech in our society, nationally and locally. And we feel like it is important for our community to explore what the realities are around free speech. So there is some perception that hate speech is not allowed or should be somehow halted, or you could be arrested for hate speech. And the reality is, as your comment earlier from Tim, it's absolutely protected no matter how hateful or vile. And so we think that this is a topic that's relevant today, and especially with some of the issues that have happened locally.
Like what? What local issues?
Well, so there was a lot of publicity around the issues at UNF around the white supremacists, around some of the hate speech that students have encountered. This is not unique to UNF. This is part of the fabric of our society right now. But people want this to be limited. Some do, some don't, in terms of can you be that hateful or threatening? And so there's a lot of case law around what constitutes an actual threat and therefore is limited.
And you're talking about a local white supremacist who was actually arrested after a appearing on the UNF campus, making threats on social media in particular.
Yes.
That happened shortly after another white supremacist who's really notorious around the country, Richard Spencer, was granted permission to speak in Gainesville at the University of Florida.
Yes.
He had also been engaged in activism over in Charlottesville, Virginia. That led, of course, to a neo-Nazi-type rally there, and it led to the death of a counter-protester. So these are extremely volatile issues in America, particularly on our college campuses, but really everywhere, Nancy.
They are everywhere. And I think Richard Spencer coming to Gainesville caused a lot more public awareness about what is allowed, what isn't allowed. Can he do that? Can he not do that? I mean, his appearance at UF generated a $600,000 expense for the university around security. And then that caused an additional question in the public eye, and that is, who's responsible for these extra expenses? OneJax is not taking a position mm-hmm. on this. Our purpose is to generate public awareness, allow a community discussion to explore these issues. And interesting, mm-hmm. Melissa, Garrett, one of our panelists next week is Gary Ettinger. Mm-hmm. He's a practicing attorney in Gainesville. He's a member of the First Amendment Lawyers Association. And
the ACLU.
And he represented Richard Spencer in his quest to speak at the University of Florida. And we have him coming up to be on the panel. And we really appreciate this diversity of viewpoint. We also have a student who was a victim of hate speech. And, well, she's an alumna now. But she will be talking about her experience. So it's our intent to allow for a lot more awareness and understanding and let people, mm-hmm. I mean, this is the ultimate expression of free speech.
Absolutely.
Know?
Now, of course, in America, we have a robust and deeply, dearly held tradition of free speech. As we see European nations in particular grappling with this issue, several European countries have passed laws explicitly banning what they term to be hate speech. You can now be arrested in some of those countries for giving voice to thoughts and ideas that are deemed hateful.
Yes.
In this country, we tend to fall more on the side of allowing free expression.
Yes,
there's
absolutely.
A big, yeah. So will this panel get into what's happening around the world, particularly as some nations are seeing a rise in authoritarian leadership and white nationalism has become a force not only in this country, but in other countries. All of these strands tie into this discussion.
They do. And we do have a UNF professor, Josh Gellers, who is going to talk about the landscape across the world. What is the legal body of work around free speech? A lot of the European nations who have passed these laws are puzzled and or amazed at the breadth of the free speech that's allowed in the United States. So this is mm-hmm. This is another piece of the discussion next week, is a reflection on what the European countries, other countries around the world. Thailand is one, too, that has a very interesting body of law around free speech.
Let's go to a few calls now, and in a moment we'll speak with philanthropist and humanitarian Laurie Dubow. He was honored by OneJax recently at their Humanitarian Awards dinner, and he has some thoughts about this, too. 549-2937. Tony is in St. John's right now. Hi, Tony. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Just a comment, really. Free speech is protected, but there are now hate crimes. Can a person's activities through hate speech then be attached to a crime? Is there any legal repercussion for them for a history of hate speech and hate activities based around speech that ultimately result in crime?
Right.
And now take your comments off the line.
Thanks, Tony. I think that this is why this is a complex legal area, Nancy
yeah.
Bronner. Other countries are now defining speech as a crime. Just words can right. now be criminalized. What about her comment?
So in the United States, and this is one of the issues that we're going to talk about next week, I'm not a legal expert, but we have discussed the fact that the case law surrounding free speech and its connection to hate crimes is quite open-ended, and that is there are strict definitions around what you can be arrested for in terms of hate speech. It has to lead to action. So people are very surprised at how far one can go. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater because it is of immediate danger. But almost a lot of other things that lead up to that are allowed. And it's mm-hmm. quite liberal.
Yeah. Lori Dubow is here now, the One Jax Silver Medallion Award winner from One Jax's recent humanitarian awards. Lori Dubow, a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And, you know, the work of One Jax is so important in this community as they spotlight not only the amazing contributions of leading citizens like you, but they spark discussions about these important issues.
Yes, they do. And it's a great entity to have here in Jacksonville. We're very fortunate.
What are your thoughts about this as we talk about the limits or if there should be any limits to free speech and our precious First Amendment in America?
Well, you're talking to the wrong guy because I think if you have something to say that's meaningful and reasonable and is not totally offensive, you should be allowed to say it.
Let's go to some more of your calls out there. Exercise your right to speech on this program right now, 549-2937. Ed is in Orange Park. Hi, Ed. Good morning.
Good morning, Candy. Thank you. Wonderful show and a very much needed topic. Can the guests think of a single case where the most left-wing radical speaker or leader of, let's say, an Antifa organization or Black Lives Matter or the head of the Communist Party or a professor who wants to turn the United States into a North Korean communist dictatorship, where they have ever been kept from speaking in a university, or people jump and attack them where they're speaking at the podium, or destruction of property or looting occurring by people who oppose their views? Because this is a problem. Anytime somebody who is conservative seems to be wanting to peacefully profess their ideas, they immediately are accused of some kind of extreme right, and they're not debated. And that goes from intellectuals like Dinesh D'Souza, Ben Shapiro, and so on. So, okay, but my main question is, can you see, give us an example of the opposite, people on the left being forbidden from speaking?
Right. And I think in particular, Ed, you're talking about what's happening on the nation's college campuses. Thanks for that call.
The center of free speech, yes.
And I think that's become a big issue on campuses, Nancy. So I think it's good that you're having this on the UNF campus. I know UNF President John Delaney, he's retiring, and he'll be moderating this event. He's spoken out about, from his point of view, that campuses should allow all types of speech. Conservative speakers, progressive speakers, the full spectrum. We've seen this trend around the country in recent years of conservative speakers in particular being invited to speak on a campus, and then there's a lot of protest and debate around it, and then they're sort of uninvited. Mm-hmm. The invitation is rescinded, essentially, and they're not allowed to speak. And so you see conservatives like Ed, who just called, saying, you know, this isn't right, this isn't American. You see liberal pundits like Bill Maher on HBO standing up and saying, no, I don't agree with anything Ann Coulter, for example, has to say, but she should be allowed to speak on a college campus. That's what this discussion's getting at, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And universities and college campuses are wrestling with this around the country. Some have banned speakers on one side or another, and they are being sued for it because the First Amendment is quite clear. And, you know, relating it to campus safety is an area that some of them cite. But this is a body of law that is still in flux, and we'll see how the lawsuits play out. But especially most people are able to quickly cite where and when Richard Spencer has been allowed or not allowed. But the case law is quite clear. We'll see what happens.
Lots of comments about this on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Jim writes, I object strongly to the premise that money is speech. If you are trapped down a well, would you yell for help or just throw money? The American voter is trapped down a well and buried in money. Eric writes, we can say whatever we want. Yes, even yell fire in a crowded theater. However, you should be prepared for a backlash if others disagree with you. Spouting hate, then be prepared for it to be returned to you. This is about acceptance, understanding, self-control, consequences, and responsibility. Lori DeBow, your thoughts.
Well, I think it's well said. There's no question about it. If you're born and raised amongst a minority, which I was, you begin to understand that. And there's more people speaking out about it. I think it's not anywhere near what it was 60, 70 years ago when I was a young boy.
What are some of your memories of that time when it comes to these issues?
Well, you know, being chased down the street because of my religion, sometimes being beat up. I remember distinctly when we would go on summer vacations into some of the areas of the Midwest, the signs in front of the resorts would say, no Jews allowed.
Right.
And that you don't see that today, obviously, at least not as prevalent, but those are things that you remember.
Sure. And they leave a mark. That's a traumatic thing for a young person to experience, this being told you don't belong or, you know, your point of view doesn't count. Mm-hmm. It's not accepted.
Yeah.
And whether we're talking about speech or even entering physical spaces in America, freedom of movement.
Yeah, well, it gears you and it educates you for what other people are going through today. So having experienced it, you understand it.
Let's go to Mike in Jacksonville. Hi, Mike. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Oh, thanks for having me on here. I was going to bring up a point, kind of echoes off some of the previous people. If you're talking about places like UNF or University of Florida, those are public schools funded by taxpayers. And I think that there's a lot of responsibility that lies on the university. Like, you wouldn't have a neo-Nazi like Mr. Spencer or, you know, some racist come to your elementary school and talk to your kids. So I think that although I'm a conservative and I believe that you should have people that represent both sides, I mean, Ann Coulter is a lot different than somebody like Mr. Spencer. So, I mean, you know, conveying conservative viewpoints as well as liberal viewpoints is something that they should be exposed to. But at some point, the university, especially when the public is funding these events, because you have to provide a venue as well as security and then deal with all the ramifications, that I think that they should be more careful. You wouldn't want maybe some ultra communist to try to rally up something, or, you know, some ultra right wing racist to speak as well. I mean, there's got to be some common sense used here.
Yeah. Okay. Mike, thanks for that. Nancy Bronner.
So I think that our discussion next Tuesday evening will explore the different responsibilities of public universities versus private. There's a lot more ability in a private setting where taxpayer dollars are not being used to limit or control the kind of speech that takes place on the campus. The caller is right. Public universities do have a different responsibility, and the First Amendment provides quite a bit of opportunity.
Now, here's another data point for both of you. This is from the Pew Research Center. 40% of American millennials say they are okay with European-style limits on speech that is deemed offensive, particularly about minority groups. They are far more likely than older generations to say that the government should be able to prevent people from saying offensive things. And so there's a generational divide when it comes to this, too. What are your thoughts about that?
There's a generational divide on a lot of things.
That's right. You just said the truth, didn't you? Yeah, but you know, what about, I mean, so 4 in 10 millennials, this is why we see this on the campuses so often, these incredibly difficult flashpoint moments. As Ed, who called in from Orange Park earlier, said, you know, he sees this as having a chilling effect on conservative speech on campus, particularly when college students and young adults say the government should be able to prevent people from saying anything publicly that is seen as offensive, particularly to minorities. And so in America, where, Lori, we have this tradition of preventing tyranny of the majority over vulnerable minority populations, at the same time, now we're looking at a world where we're grappling with, well, is speech a form of tyranny over minority groups, or is that a misguided way of looking at this?
Well, it's pretty obvious that speech is a tremendous weapon, and it's being used more and more now than ever before. One of the best orators that I had heard as a young boy was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he explained it well. And he lived and was the president during an era when, excuse me, in Europe, there was an awful lot of discretion and prosecution and some bad things going on. So if you live through that, you see things differently when it comes to these particular subjects. Growing up today is much, much different than growing up 70 years ago. It just absolutely is. What you see, what you read, what you hear, and I'm not saying that today is wrong and we were all right, but it's just different.
Catherine emails the show, a university also has a duty to the safety of the students. Often the speaker asks to use the venue, but may not be invited. Speakers have the right to speak, but not necessarily anywhere they choose. Thanks for that, Catherine. Let's go to Carlos on the South Side. Carlos, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I'm in this country for the past 2 years. I came to this country from Venezuela. And what I hear here on this radio station, it got my blood boil. That's how the regime of Chavez started. It's a sneaky way. We have to control what they say. It can be offended to the government. And look at what we got. I'm sorry. I'm in complete disagreement with what you guys are saying. Freedom of speech. If you don't know speech, what happened with the irrational debate of opinion? I don't need to be banned because I don't agree with you. And I think that's the problem with those regimes, totalitarian regimes, Maduro, Castro's, and China. I'm sorry. I've seen this in my country, and look at the way my country is born. I don't want that in this country.
Carlos, I so appreciate the call.
Yeah, 100%.
Carlos, thank you so much for the call. So here's Carlos, who's moved here from Venezuela, and he's seen what happens when free speech is muffled. I think that's why in America we tend to fall on the err on the side of we allow speech that we deeply disagree with because the most important thing is to protect free flow of expression.
Yes, definitely. And Carlos, you know, just want to clarify that we are not taking a position to limit free speech. Our purpose is exactly what is happening, which is to air out what are the definitions related to the First Amendment. Lori brought up a good point about living through the World War II, living through a lot of the what you lived through, Carlos, and that is what happens when free speech is limited. What does that allow to happen in government? So this is you're exactly right. This is why we need to be talking about it.
Right. And I'm glad Carlos called.
I am too.
That's why, and frankly, that's why we provide this platform here on the show and at WJCT, because we feel here at the station that it is so important to provide a forum for open public discussion and debate and include everyone who has the ability to call in or tweet or email the show. And so thanks for that call, Carlos. Thanks to everyone who called. And if you want to keep the discussion going, you need to come out to UNF next Tuesday night, May 1st, for the latest installment of this city's Civil Discourse series. a discussion around the First Amendment. It'll be moderated by UNF President John Delaney. There'll be some great panelists and a really lively discussion. It's our American tradition. So come on out for that. Nancy Bronner, thanks for being here today representing One Jacks.
You're welcome. Yes. I enjoyed it.
And Lori Dubow, a Silver Medallion Humanitarian Award winner with One Jacks, a great American and humanitarian and philanthropist. We thank you for being here, too.
Thank you very much.
Much more still ahead later, singer Robbie Litt. But up next, from the First Amendment to the Second Amendment, African Americans in Jacksonville talk about the gun debate in our Real Talk. That's next.
Miguel Sanon.
I'm Nora Jones.
My name is Pedrito Martinez.
I'm Christian McBride with Jazz Night in America. Our new show is bringing you inside the jazz world. We're headed to concerts around the country, from New York to L.A. to D.C., and we're talking directly to musicians, finding out how and why they do what they do. Join me right here for Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me every Thursday evening at 11 p.m. for Avant Radio, a show of curious music for curious minds. Each show is themed, curated, and contextualized to explore new music. Come get curious on Thursdays at 11 on 89.9 FM.
I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. From the State House to the Everglades to the Panhandle, Florida has a unique story.
So join us every Friday for the Florida Roundup.
And hear from newsmakers, journalists, and Floridians from all across the state.
About the issues that matter to you.
The Florida Roundup, Fridays at 1 on WJCT.
Unlock your newest member benefit. Over 1,000 episodes of your favorite PBS shows. American Masters. Antiques Roadshow, Nature, Nova, Masterpiece. Watch the best of PBS anytime, anywhere. Become a member, sign in, and start streaming today.
WJCT.org/passport.
Welcome back. The gun debate in America has heard from many points of view over the last several months. But we have not always heard the voices of African Americans on this vital issue. And it's a debate that affects African Americans intensely. So this morning, we are getting that perspective. It's our Real Talk today on the show with our own contributor and board member, Charles Griggs. He's talking the Second Amendment with a group of his friends and colleagues. Take a listen.
Hello, it's time for Real Talk. That's where we talk to interesting people around the First Coast about what's in the news and what's going on in their minds as it specifically relates to the African-American community. I'm Charles Griggs, WJCT First Coast Connect contributor and your host for today's discussion. Talking with us today is Rhonda Peoples-Waters. She's an attorney and legal expert. It's good to see you again.
Hi, thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. Ken Jefferson, action news crime and safety expert. Ken, thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And finally, Dr. Jeffrey Ann Wilder. Dr. Wilder is a professor of sociology at the University of North Florida.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me.
All right. Well. Guns. Since the fatal shooting of 17 students and staff members at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, advocates of stricter gun laws have been pursuing new normals for laws that protect Second Amendment rights and provide common sense prevention to gun violence. Many polls reveal that Americans favor banning assault-style weapons. However, some feel any ban will begin the process of eventually outlawing guns altogether. And what about black gun ownership? Could this be a sleight-of-hand strategy towards gun restrictions? For example, in 1987, Black Panther Party members legally carried weapons to guard against police brutality. This led to California legislation prohibiting the open carry of weapons in public places. Excluding mass shootings, what about everyday gun violence? Last year in Jacksonville, there was about 16% increase in homicides over 2016, most of them committed while using a gun. So where do we go from here? And where is the prevention opportunity in violent and gun control debate, especially in the Black community? Rhonda, is there room for debate on how the Second Amendment currently impacts the prevention of gun violence?
Absolutely. There is quite a bit of room for debate. And I'll just start by saying we know that traditionally in the African American community, I think that I've heard or understood that African Americans are fonder or favor stricter gun laws. And I think that obviously dates back to just tradition and what the exposure has been, as well as the gun violence that we've seen directly impact the African American communities. But I also think, you know, the other part of that argument is not just being a gun owner, but African Americans have to consider themselves as Black gun owners, because that gun ownership could subject you to a completely different realm of thought, where you're going to have an encounter with a police officer potentially, and you end up being the person who is shot because you have identified yourself as a gun owner. So that's definitely part of the argument that I believe has to continue in our debate.
So that's the challenge. The challenge is, how do you manage your rights as a gun owner? Is there a benefit to engaging African Americans and encouraging them to own, become gun owners?
Well, there's certainly a benefit. Let me just trace back to my childhood when I was growing up. My grandfather and father were avid hunters, so they were gun owners. It wasn't as explicit as it is today with ownership of guns. Back then, you had a gun in your pickup truck racked on the rear windshield. That was normal. Now the new normal is concealed weapons, mm-hmm. have them concealed and concealed carry, as well as open carry in some states. Let me make this clear. The guns in and of itself is not the issue. It's the gun owners or the gun operator, if you will.
Okay.
Not being responsible or being callous with certain things. Now, let me address the police issue thing that just came up with regards to African-Americans and guns. And this is coming from a law enforcement background, so mm-hmm. understand my perspective.
That's why you're here.
Thank you. With regards to African-Americans or anyone for that matter carrying a gun, and I know this is simple to say, but you have to follow the instructions. There have been some that have been killed who followed the instructions and still got killed. I understand that argument. I understand that issue. However, if you are a responsible gun owner, let's just say you get stopped by the police, the first thing you want to do is keep your hands visible and let him know or her know that you are a gun owner and you are carrying a weapon. That officer, from that point on, knows the procedure, knows the protocol, knows what to do from that point on. Don't reach forward and say, hey, I'm a licensed gun owner, and here's my weapon. You don't want to ever reach for anything. You want to be in plain sight. And I know some things have gone awry with the result of that, and that's really the discussion today.
So I think I'm glad you brought that up, because I think the perception is that when African-Americans are in a situation where they are legally carrying a gun, legally carrying a firearm, and they disclose that information, there is a certain anxiety that comes along with that on both parties. And that has led to some of the outcomes that we've seen that, you know, that don't benefit African Americans. So, and I think that there are lessons to be learned, you know, like you're mentioning, what the person should do, what the carrier should do. You know, what we want to understand as African Americans is that what is being done to help the officers what to do, because there should be some compensation for the anxiety that both parties are being put in. Dr. Wilder, what do you think about how the outcomes have been portrayed and the impact it has had on gun control measures that are currently being proposed out here in our country today?
So I think, sociologically speaking, I think part of the issue with the Second Amendment and all the various things that sort of collide, if you will, or intersect with the Second Amendment, like Stand Your Ground and racial profiling, all these things, is that there are certainly, we can go back extremely far, and even as recently as, this week, this past week, looking at the very uneven consequences of the application of the law along racial and gendered lines. So in other words, when you think about who benefits the most potentially from a Stand Your Ground, it certainly isn't people like Marissa Alexander. Mm-hmm. It's really more people like Michael Dunn, who murdered Jordan Davis right here in Jacksonville. When we think about, the application of Stand Your Ground, it's also folks like George Zimmerman. So I think the problem that folks have is recognizing that when the law was written, when the Second Amendment was written, who was it written for? Right. Now, obviously, things have changed and we are much further down the line in American society. But again, the application of the law, the utility of the law is not uneven. And it always, well, I shouldn't say always, it a lot of times it's disadvantageous to folks in the Black American community. Yeah, that's
so,
the issue.
So and that, you know, that, I think that's the, you know, the really the perception. But the law is the law. And Rhonda, so how do we pursue the equity and administration of the law when we know that the law has been adversely impacting African Americans?
Right. And I agree. Definitely the law is the law, but it's only applied through us as individuals and humans and jurists. So when you have those circumstances where you have African Americans attempting to assert self-defense, I believe one of the biggest ways that we can definitely assist to make sure that the entire community understands that self-defense also applies and can be utilized by African Americans is educate them. And we have to educate African Americans, which would possibly be through town hall forums on what is the justifiable use of deadly force. How can you utilize that? What type of force do you have to have coming against you that will allow you to be able to justifiably use deadly or non-deadly use of force? What type of threat? So we have to have those type of forums. We also have to educate African Americans specifically as it relates to the carrying the concealed weapons permit and what that allows. I think that that's an important concept that we see quite a bit in, you know, my criminal law experience, where we have young African American males who are possessing guns and they really have not been, you know, educated as well. And we have to understand, and I know you're like, well, why do we have to educate young Black males? Because they're the ones who are being stopped. Yeah. And so we have to make sure that we educate them that getting those type of permits, obviously, if you're 21, you're going to be able to do that. But if you don't have a permit, you can still have the gun. You just have to follow those rules, which means if you don't have a permit to have that gun securely encased and make sure that it's not in a reachable or readily accessible area if it's in your vehicle. So we are seeing so many of those type of cases in the criminal justice system.
Okay. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Real Talk. My name is Charles Griggs, and joining me is Rhonda Peoples-Waters, Ken Jefferson, and Dr. Jeffrey Ann Wilder, and we're discussing the impacts of gun violence and gun control. One of the things that I really wanted to get into as we have this discussion is really the Second Amendment. And, you know, the debate around the Second Amendment is vast and wide. And what we're hearing on both sides is that the Second Amendment is being still administered in its pure state as it was back in 1791, but many people believe that it does not apply to today. Dr. Wilder, do you think that there's room for for some measured change around Second Amendment laws and how it impacts us as a community? Because militia, you know, we could use any, we could, for our right to bear arms, what are we talking about? Are we talking about assault rifles? Are we talking about handguns? Are we talking about, you know, tanks or what? You know, nuclear missiles?
Well, I definitely think there's room for change. And I think we're starting to see that already with the tragedy in Parkland. And even well before Parkland, the continued conversation around assault rifles and particularly how they're being used in a lot of school tragedies and even the sort of connected conversation of whether or not teachers should be armed in the classroom. Again, when you think about that, I think that we really don't have a choice at this point but to revisit the law because there's some real life, literally, consequences for that. And again, I think if we're going to be revisionist about the law, we also need to be careful and clarify, again, who's impacted, and making sure that we can make some type of revision to policies and practices where they're truly equitable for all of our citizens, right? Yeah. Whether or not they carry guns or not.
Yeah. So how do you think this Second Amendment impacts crime prevention? What kind of impact does it actually have on gun violence? Because we don't really have a lot of data around people on gun ownership and what it really does to prevent, crime.
Well, advocates of the Second Amendment would argue that it does prevent crime because it's a self-defense mode. You have the ability to carry a weapon to prevent harm of yourself as well as others, to protect your castle, things like that. I firmly believe in the Second Amendment. However, I do think that now it's up for discussion. The discussion has started, and our lawmakers really need to pay attention to what's being said on both sides. On both sides, you've got your staunch people who advocate, you're not going to take my gun away. But that's not the point of the issue. The issue is not to take your weapons away, but to improve the process and make it fair and equitable for everybody is what the objective is. And when, back in the 1700s, they didn't have assault weapons. So the right to bear arms meant something any different. Kind of arms you wanted.
Yeah.
And it's still the same today. Yeah. It's any kind of arms you wanted. But as we see throughout our nation, throughout our country, that the assault weapon is the weapon of choice for mass destruction.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to find out because we don't have data on how much crime or violent crime is being prevented by gun ownership. I don't know if any of you have any information on that, but that's been the data that's been eluding us for, throughout this debate.
I'm not certain of the numbers, but gun owners would tell you it's a peace of mind that they have when they have
psychologically,
proactively, however you want to phrase it. It's a peace of mind. I'm a gun owner. I carry a weapon on a regular basis, almost always. And it's psychologically my peace of mind to say that, okay, if I'm assaulted, if I'm approached, if I'm about to be robbed or someone's trying to hurt my family, then I have the ability to defend myself. I don't have to retreat. I have the ability to defend myself and my family. And that's my constitutional right to do that. So what we need to do is balance all of these other issues with regards to that.
So as we wrap up, Dr. Water, what do you think is next for policy, the policy discussion? I mean, we've seen some movement around age restrictions, and we've seen some movement potentially around assault weapons. How far do you think we'll go with this in the coming years?
Hopefully tightening the background system and the waiting period. What I would personally like to see sort of more immediately is voter turnout, because I think that's going to have a big impact in the short term with this. So ultimately, though, I personally would like to see a more extended, detailed process around, and again, an extended waiting period around who's able to have access to assault rifles.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to have to leave it there for now. Thank you all very so much for a spirited conversation. Rondell Peoples Waters, Ken Jefferson, and Dr. Jeffrey Ann Wilder. And to our audience, we'll talk to you next time on Real Talk. I'm Charles Griggs, your host.
Thanks, Charles. In a moment, performer Robbie Litt and the Palm Valley Historic District Festival. That's after this.
The Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville and PNC Bank present the 42nd Annual Arts Awards on May 5th. Al Letson hosts the Seated Dinner with an interactive installation by Castano Group and the Chris Thomas Band. More at brighterawards.com. Newsy, the TV news channel with a mission to bring in-depth context on the significant stories, people, and events that shape the world. More information about Newsy is available at newsy.com/watch.
On the next Fresh Air, Jake Tapper, CNN's chief Washington correspondent and anchor of The Lead and State of the Union, will talk about his new novel set in 1954 McCarthy-era Washington and similarities he sees today, And we'll discuss how he deals with guests he interviews from the Trump administration when they promote falsehoods or evade his questions. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Coming up on The World.
Frying catfish is a great thing to take to a tailgate that's something different.
This Alabama fish farmer raises millions of catfish, but he has a hard time getting a good price for them. Catfish imported from Vietnam are cheaper. That's despite high trade tariffs imposed by Washington. Alabama fish farmers fight to keep Vietnamese catfish out. That's on The World. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
What's it like to get burned by the cabinet nomination process? Andrew Puzder had been President Trump's pick for Labor Secretary. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called him an outstanding choice, but accusations about his personal life and his time running a fast food chain tripped him up. Andrew Puzder, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, Dining Out for Life is today a national event helping HIV and AIDS charities like the Northeast Florida AIDS Network. Go out today for lunch or dinner and just pick a local restaurant from the website diningoutforlife.com. Food Network star Ted Allen of the hit show Chopped is the national spokesman for Dining Out for Life. I talked to him about the cause.
Dining Out for Life is a really elegant model that has been repurposed by any number of fundraisers. Anybody who's trying to raise money for anything, the first place they all turn is the restaurant community, where they're asking chefs to donate a dinner, and they always say yes. Restaurants are such an integral part of American culture. I think they see that sort of community involvement as a big part of their DNA.
Again, Dining Out for Life today, lunch and dinner. Pick a restaurant and go support the cause. Go to diningoutforlife.com. Finally, this hour, it's going to be a fun family day of art, storytelling, music, and fun this weekend at the Palm Valley Historic District Festival. Here with more, we welcome festival spokeswoman Donna Carrasco. Good morning.
Good morning.
And local singer-songwriter Robbie Litt. Good to see you.
Hey there. Good morning.
In a moment, we'll hear about Robbie's new album and his performance. But first, Donna Carrasco, tell me what's going to be happening. This is all to support the Palm Valley Historic District Initiative.
Yes. Thanks, Melissa, for having us on your show. We really appreciate it. So we are in the process of partnering with several entities in St. John's County to create a Palm Valley Historic District in honor of our founding fathers, the Oestreichers, Meiklers, and several other families.
And that's your family, the Oestreichers.
That's my family, the Oestreichers.
Right.
That's right. That's right. So we are holding our first fundraiser Saturday, the 28th, at North Guana Outpost from 11 to 5, a family-filled fun day with music, food trucks, kayak launching, art, face painting. Excuse me. We are expecting over around 300 people without even advertising it.
All word of mouth.
All word of mouth and social media. And we have partnered this year with Robbie Litt, our music headliner. Robbie and I met last year and just had an immediate connection. He's an amazing person with an amazing band and an amazing family, so I'm excited to have him as part of this year.
Now, Robbie, you're going to be performing in the evening of this event on Saturday, and you're also coming out with a new album. Tell me about it.
We are. We've been working on it for a long time, and it has eight songs on the album. We're just really excited. We're really, really proud of this. We've worked really, really hard on it. It's coming out in about probably five or six weeks.
Excellent. So look for that album to drop, but come on out Saturday to the Palm Valley Historic District Festival. This is all day and then even in the evening to benefit this initiative to preserve this beautiful historic area. Now, you're going to be performing that night, Robbie, but we have a preview right now. What's the song we're going to hear?
It's called Black, White, and Blue. This song was written to support the police. And all the proceeds from this song go towards the Police Memorial Fund, which is quite a good cause. Our bass player actually is my wife, and she's out singing the national anthem at Memorial Day, so it's kind of very timely today.
Oh, very nice. Just go on Facebook and look for the Palm Valley Historic District page and find out more about this Saturday's really cool event. Donna Carrasco, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Robbie Litt, let's listen to your song right now. Take a listen.
I was tough and I was mean. Mama taught me there's some things you just don't do. There's some lines you never cross and some valleys you don't toss, even if you think it's different for you. Shame on people who forgot what's right and wrong. Don't be sitting on the fence. There ain't no way to make amends, 'cause you can't bring back the dead once they're gone. And here's to you, those in blue. Thanks for everything you do. I just want you to know someone cares.
Come on out and see Robbie this Saturday at the first annual Palm Valley Historic District Initiative. Search their page on Facebook all day Saturday at the North Quanah Outpost. Thanks for being here, everybody. 1A is up next. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by...